I can't do everything today, but I will take one small step. Morning sets the day. This too shall pass. More is not indicative of better. These are some of the best mantras for efficiency, at least according to the online influencers I found when I Googled productivity mantra. That Google search came back with a lot of hits. It seems like mantras have been fully integrated into capitalism. Some websites I found even talked about Buddhism and Hinduism, or had pictures of peaceful suburban office employees seated cross-legged with their eyes closed and their hands folded. Then they all gave a list of powerful mantras to help you at your 9-to-5. But why do we call these positive thinking English sayings mantras or mantras? If you look for Sanskrit mantras online, you'll find videos of people chanting things like These videos also proclaim Sanskrit mantras to be powerful. Often they proclaim this in all caps, specifying particular ailments that the mantras are supposed to have an impact on. So, what are mantras? What are they supposed to do, and how? How could mere words have power over mind, body, and workplace? In this podcast, we'll investigate these questions with a look at the mantras and some controversies over their role as an instrument, and controversies over their meanings. We'll also ask where mantras come from and where we can get them. Could I Google for a mantra to help me? Do I need to wait for one to come to me? And how would I know it's the right mantra for me? I'm Malcolm Keating, and you're listening to Sutras and Stuff. If you've been listening to earlier episodes in this season, you'll have picked up on a theme. It's that there's rarely one simple concept associated with the Sanskrit words we're considering, and the term mantra is no exception. Just like avatara and karman and their anglicized counterparts, avatar and karma, the word mantra has a whole lot of understandings which vary depending on which tradition, thinker, time, and place you're considering. And like avatar and karma, there is an anglicized pronunciation, mantra, and a Sanskrit one, mantra. In the podcast, I'll use mantra when I'm talking about the loan word and mantra when I'm talking about the concept in pre-modern Sanskrit material. I tend to say mantra just out of habit, so that's what I'll default to. But let's start by dispelling some myths about Sanskrit mantras that you may have encountered already. First myth to dispel. Understood as a natural human language, Sanskrit is not the oldest language to exist or the source of all other languages. So if you've heard that this is where the power of mantras come from, well, linguists and historians will beg to differ. A second myth to dispel, and one more relevant to this podcast, that's that mantras have power because of one particular reason. Well, in fact, there were long ancient debates over whether and how mantras have power. For those who did think that they had power, one major debate was whether the power was because of sound or because of meaning. So if you've heard mantras are only and all about sound or vibrations, well, that is one idea, but it's not the only one. So let's dive into what mantras are in Sanskrit, and we'll start with the word mantra. It's composed of a verbal part, man, and an ending, tra. That ending usually conveys that something is an instrument. The verbal part, mun, has a wide range of meanings, and they're about the mind broadly, things like thought, insight, even desire or passion or intention. So a mantra is an instrument for these things. Mantras appear in some of the earliest Sanskrit literature, in the collection of orally transmitted texts known as the Veda. Dating is controversial and difficult, but the origins of these texts, before they were written and collected, go back perhaps to the 15th or 16th century before the Common Era, during the Late Bronze Age. These mantras, though, are special instruments. In the Rig Veda, for instance, they are recited to gods, and they are also the recited names of gods. But they're not just words, they are powerful words, words which accompany ritual actions, and without them, the rituals aren't effective. These mantras must be recited while laying foundations of temples and ritual structures, while carving an image of a god, while bathing. It actually might be quicker for me to list situations when mantras should not be recited. Now, mantras were so widely recognized as examples of powerful speech that Nyaya philosophers, whom we've talked about before on this podcast, appealed to them when they were arguing that testimony is a special way of knowing, something different from perception or inferential reasoning. Nyaya philosophers argued that testimony is useful and effective, just like mantras when they're used to neutralize a poison, for instance. This was supposed to be an uncontroversial example that everybody could accept. Now, we're not going to focus on Nyaya in this episode. Instead, we'll be talking about a tradition known as Mimamsa. Mimamsa philosophers were hermeneuticists, whose name shares the verbal root in mantra, which is mun. That tradition goes back to Jaimini, author of the Mimamsa Sutras, and he lived sometime between the 5th to the 3rd century before the Common Era. Mimamsa philosophers were kind of early philosophers of action and language, and they focused a lot of effort on explaining mantras and their power. Now, if mantras are so powerful, so prevalent, and so old, you might wonder, where do they originally come from? In the 1980s, long after Mimamsa philosophers, a mathematician and philosopher-turned-Indologist suggested a controversial thesis, and that's that mantras are for the birds. Or rather, mantras are for us like birdsong is for the birds. Fritz Stahl was the founder of UC Berkeley's South and Southeast Asian Studies Department. He was also an eminent Dutch scholar who did field work in India and did abstract textual analysis in the Ivory Tower. He became famous, or famous for an academic, for filming an important Vedic ritual known as the Agni Chayana.
The ritual patron or sacrificer, with the help of Agni and Vedic mantras, asks the gods for strength, wealth, children, and immortality.
In Stahl's opinion, the structure of mantras, that is, their repetition and their patterns, is more important than whatever meanings they might have, which he argued was often not much and was really beside the point. This, he thought, is like birdsong. Birds have regular repeated calls, but he claimed no language, at least not language in the sense of communicating meanings. Further, while Stahl thought that aspects of mantras and birdsong are innate and instinctual, both also have parts which are learned. So then, what are mantras and birdsong for? Well, both are enjoyable. They're playful structures. And most strikingly, Stahl concluded that mantras and birdsong share another similarity. They predate language. His idea, then, was that language emerged from mantras, and that mantras harken back to a pre-linguistic ineffable state. Now, while it doesn't confirm all of Stahl's wide-ranging and controversial hypothesis about birdsong, language, and mantras, research in linguistics is ongoing into the structure of birdsong and what it might tell us about how human beings learn language and what parts of language are innate.
One of the primary reasons why we study songbirds is that they're one of the few vertebrate species that, like humans, are not born with their ability to sing their songs, but they actually have to learn them during development, so they have to learn their vocalizations. And interestingly, the brain circuits that underlie this vocal learning are highly similar to the brain circuits that are underlying speech learning and language learning in humans. So we think that we can gain a lot of information about potential mechanisms of speech and language learning in humans by studying songbirds.
And so we found that across all the birds we tutored, they tended to do certain similar kinds of patterns, which suggests to us that they had these predispositions in learning to produce particular types of sequences. And not only that, but they actually tended to map some of the kinds of patterns that we also see in human language and human music.
As I said, the range of phenomena called mantra is vast, and Stahl's hypothesis is grand. Modern critics argue that he's ignoring those mantras which would undermine his thesis. And some pre-modern critics would likely side with these modern critics. These are the philosophers belonging to the Mimamsa tradition that I mentioned earlier. Though they didn't know Stahl's work, of course, they had some opponents who argued for somewhat similar conclusions. Kumarila Bhatta is a famous Mimamsa philosopher who argued against the idea that mantras don't communicate any meaning. Kumarila thought that not only did the meaning of mantras play an important role in Vedic ritual, but that the purpose of reciting these mantras was to communicate meaning. During the regular new and full moon ritual, which happened at the times you might expect from the name, a Brahmin would make some rice cakes for the deity Agni, who's the fire god. That Brahmin would pour water into a shallow dish that had some ground rice meal inside, and then he'd mix it together to make some rice cakes, which would eventually be burned up. And as this Brahmin performed the actions, he'd say, in Sanskrit, "I pour together, for generation I unite you." Now, this is a mantra, and Kumarila argues that by saying these words, the Brahmin is reminded of what he must do to fulfill his ritual obligations. Remember that mantra means something like an instrument for thinking or insight. It's something cognitive, which is what the man in mantra means. Kumarila and other Mimamsa philosophers take this etymology seriously. Plus, if mantras are part of Vedic texts, they must have some purpose, and just uttering words for the sake of uttering sounds isn't a very good purpose. So Kumarila would take issue with Stahl in two important ways. First, Kumarila thinks that Vedic language and human language aren't radically different kinds of language. He's very insistent on this, reiterating it many times throughout his writings. It's important because he thinks that if Vedic language were radically different, then we wouldn't be able to understand it. The main difference between the Veda, the ancient texts that contain mantras, and human language, is that the Veda doesn't have an author, according to Kumarila. There's no intelligent being, human or divine, that originated them. These texts have just always existed. However, when it comes to uttering mantras, there are real human beings who are reciting them. They just aren't the authors. So when Stahl argues that mantras are a kind of pre-linguistic form, if that's supposed to radically distinguish mantras from ordinary language, well, then Kumarila would disagree. There's another way that Kumarila might disagree, and that's about the point of mantras. To appreciate this disagreement, we need to go back in time, even before Kumarila, to introduce an ancient thinker called Kautsa. Kautsa argued that mantras are meaningless, and that any meanings we can interpret from them are beside the point. His arguments show up in an old text called the Nirukta, written by somebody named Yaska. The Nirukta is about etymology, the study of the history of words and their component parts. Part of Yaska's etymology was to help understand mantras. By analyzing obscure Vedic words into smaller meaningful parts, he thought we could understand them. But Kautsa argues that since mantras are meaningless, Yaska's whole project is also meaningless and is pretty foolish. One of Kautsa's more convincing arguments, he had quite a few, focuses on how mantras have a fixed word order. Think about even a mantra in the contemporary sense. I started with one that says, "Morning sets the day." This is supposed to be something that you repeat to yourself regularly, maybe every morning. But would the mantra be as powerful if you changed the words every time you said it? Something like, "How I start my morning impacts the rest of my day. Start the day one way and the rest of the day will follow. The morning is influential for the whole day." Now, these are three different ways of saying basically the same thing. They replace the words of the mantra with synonyms, and then they reorder it. Advice about modern mantras, though, tells us that we should say the same words every time. It doesn't tell us that we should just express the same idea every time. Something similar and even more strict happens in Vedic ritual. The exact same words need to be used in the same ritual and in the exact same order every time for the mantras to work. If this doesn't happen, then a ritual aiming at, for instance, wealth or the birth of a son, some common goals for rituals in Vedic times, well, they're not going to work. Now, Kaltze concludes that the requirement for a specific order of words and a specific set of words shows that mantras aren't meaningful. At least that's how his argument is explained in the Nirukta. Back to Kumarala. Kumarala tweaks his argument in a way that I think makes it stronger and also makes it more like Stahl's point about birdsong. Kumarala thinks his opponent's point shouldn't be that a mantra like I pour together has no meaning. Of course it has a meaning. It's composed of meaningful words. Kumarala thinks the question is about whether this meaning is intended. In other words, is the goal of the Brahman when he pronounces certain words to communicate some meaning? Or is the goal something else? This is similar to birdsong because we might think that birds aren't intending to communicate a meaning when they chirp. At least they aren't intending to communicate by composing meaningful utterances from more fundamental, meaningful parts. Notes in a bird's song aren't the equivalent to words in a sentence. Rather, birdsong does things like warn about predators and attract mates by using some preset structures that do get modified. Birds aren't trying to get other birds to recognize what they're doing. They're responding to their environment with some mostly innate, partly learned structures. Language, on the other hand, at least human language, is about sharing a meaning. It's about getting someone else to recognize what you're doing with some words. If I say, the morning sets the day, or the way you start the morning impacts your day, I utter either sentence with the intention that you recognize something I'm trying to communicate. And this is what Kumarala says should be the question. When someone utters a mantra in a ritual, are they intending to communicate some meaning, or are they doing something else? Take, for example, these utterances. Test, 1, 2, 3. Mic check, 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 1, 2, 3, check. Okay, so now neither of those utterances is aiming to communicate anything. The person speaking is, well, just testing a mic. Their goal is about the sound. It's not about the meaning. So something like this is going on with mantras. And Kumarala thinks this is the strongest skeptical argument about mantras. Yes, they have meanings in some very limited sense, like the words in test 1, 2, 3, but those utterances aren't aiming to communicate. And that's why, for the Kautsa-style skeptic that Kumarala is engaging with, Vedic training focuses so much on pronunciation. So for this opponent, who thinks that mantras might have some meaning, but that's not the focus, if the focus were meaning, it wouldn't matter so much how the words are pronounced. But that's what the focus is in Vedic training, is learning how to pronounce the words.
Wingardium Leviosa. Stop, stop, stop. You're going to take someone's eye out. Besides, you're saying it wrong. It's Leviosa, not Leviosa.
You do it then if you're so clever.
Go on, go on.
Wingardium Leviosa.
Oh, well done. See here, everyone. This grade has done it. Splendid.
In Harry Potter, Hermione corrects Ron about his pronunciation because he's furiously waving a wand while uttering a spell incorrectly. It's not working. Hermione is able to make the spell work because she has the proper pronunciation as well as emphasis. If Yaska or Kumarala were to analyze the spell Wingardium Leviosa, which I've probably mispronounced, they might look at its composite parts. According to dictionary.com, that all authoritative source, in Latin, ardus means high or steep, and levis means light and weight. Of course, in English, wing means to take flight. All this put together gets us a spell that levitates objects. However, a Kautsa-style skeptic would argue that this etymology is fruitless for actually getting the spell right. A student should focus on pronouncing syllables correctly and in the right order. Who cares what it means? Kumarala's response to this skeptic is brief. First, the reason that students learn how to pronounce mantras correctly and focus on that instead of the meaning is because it's harder to pronounce them right than to understand their meaning. If you've ever tried to learn a new language, you might appreciate this point. Being able to recognize the meanings of words isn't too tough since it's mostly memorization. But attempt to speak French in Paris and be prepared for your pronunciation to be the subject of some light to moderate ridicule. As for the order of words that we mentioned earlier, Kumarla simply says that we only call particular ways of expressing meanings with the term mantra. But that doesn't mean we couldn't express the same thing with other words. It's just that in the context of a ritual, the Veda has named certain set phrases mantra. Now, there's a lot more to say about the debate between Kumarla and the skeptic of mantric meaning, but let's turn to these set phrases. What are they? Could I make up my own? Are there only Vedic mantras? What about Buddhist, Sikh, Jain, other kinds of mantras?
His girlfriend's beautiful.
Yeah, she's great looking. Great. Little tad on the androgynous side.
I forgot my mantra.
It's not exactly clear why Jeff Goldblum shows up in Annie Hall at a party saying he forgot his mantra, but this 1977 film shows that mantra in the U.S. had become mainstream. Goldblum's unnamed character has his own mantra. This is very different than the mantras that Kumarla and the Mimamsakas are concerned with. It wouldn't make sense, really, for someone in that context to have a personal mantra. But the idea of a personal mantra became common from books like Choose Your Own Mantra by Lalita in 1978, and it continues today with titles like 2019's Find Your Mantra by Isel Gunnar. In some ways, the idea of a personal mantra is a relatively recent modern creation, but it does originate from practices in the Indian subcontinent, practices that involve teachers or gurus choosing a mantra that suits their students precisely and then passing it along at a certain stage, at a point of initiation. This kind of traditional passing of mantras is a practice found in lots of contexts. Hopefully I'll have an episode on the term guru, which is another Sanskrit word that's become common in English. But gurus passing on mantras are found in Sikhism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and all of these traditions incorporate mantras in different ways, with different understandings of how they're effective and indeed what they affect. Unlike the Mimamsa conception of mantras as a meaningful reminder of what to do in a ritual, another common understanding of mantras is that their power is in their reverberations, their particular sounds. This is a view that's especially associated with a word that merits its own podcast episode too, Om. Modern yoga students know the word, but so do Buddhist meditators as they chant Om Mani Padme Hum. It's not exactly a word, really, but more a syllable. For many, it's an especially sacred syllable. In the Upanishads, it's associated with creation, with fundamental reality, with the self, and reflecting on it and saying it, chanting it, is supposed to be a way to come to know reality and to transform yourself. One Upanishad, the Mandukya, starts by saying that the syllable is the entire world. Even some Buddhists who reject Upanishadic ideas still think of Om as sacred. This is the case for a lot of Tibetan Buddhists who chant Om Mani Padme Hum, that Sanskrit mantra whose meaning is somewhat controversial but is something like praise the jewel in the lotus, and is talking probably about Buddhism. Particular sounds then, like Om, are deeply connected to truth and reality, and mantras are supposed to be ways to know and approach these, truth and reality. Now, this might seem strange, but modern practitioners of various mantric traditions point to growing scientific literature on the way that sound impacts the human brain. Couldn't it be that mantras have some deep neurological effect that we don't yet understand? While I'm certainly not in a position to advocate for or mostly to evaluate claims about brains' alpha waves and their relationship to syllables like om, I can't say whether a curated selection of mantras is better than a Spotify deep focus playlist or what the underlying scientific evidence is for what either one does. The point here is just that the idea of mantras as having effects due to sound is also common in the history of Indian philosophy, even if what that sound is was the subject of dispute. After all, Buddhists certainly wouldn't accept the Upanishadic claim that Om is the fundamental reality, the simultaneously personal and impersonal Brahman. And Sikhs and Jains likewise have different ideas, which unfortunately I don't have enough time to get into. But while we're talking about sounds and Buddhism, let me conclude with one more myth to bust. That's the Tibetan singing bowl. Tibetan singing bowls are often associated both with Om in that Sanskrit mantra earlier, Om Mani Padme Hum, and with mantras. Probably you'll hear these bowls starting or ending a meditation session or being used for sound baths to heal you of everything from stress to cancer. And if you go to Tibet, you'll find them being sold everywhere, which might suggest an ancient Tibetan origin. However, it's quite possible that these bowls are really an American New Age musical invention. That's the sound of Nancy Hennings and Henry Wolff's first track from their 1972 album, Tibetan Bells. They released quite a few of these albums. There was Tibetan Bells, Tibetan Bells 2, Tibetan Bells 3, and even Tibetan Bells 4. The duo claimed to have used Tibetan instruments, but there's no scholarly evidence of any such instruments existing in Tibet before this point. There is a Japanese bell that's played similarly. It's in an inverted position on a cushion, and it's struck with a wooden stick to make a sound. It's used in temples. However, the rin, as it's called, isn't a bowl. It's a bell that's turned upside down, and it wasn't used in Tibet. As Samuel Grimes puts it in his article on the topic in Tricycle, Tibetan singing bowls have become a commodified version of Tibetan spirituality, easily packaged, sold, and distributed in a global online market. He goes on to say that the idea that the sound bowl vibrations can effortlessly bring about some kind of spiritual transformation reinforces the flattening of centuries of tradition, that's the Tibetan tradition, into a single and easily accessible trip or sound. Grimes goes on to say that the bowls are small, easy to use, and exotic. They're guaranteed to bring tranquility and de-stressing. And in this way, Tibetan singing bowls aren't entirely unlike the modern conception of mantras or mantras. But as we've seen in just this little episode, even in ancient times, mantras aren't easy to use or a guarantee. They require training, practice, and a teacher-student relationship often. We might think we know what Tibetan singing bowls are. They're Tibetan religious objects that bring enlightenment through sound. It turns out, though, that their origins are more complicated, and the same goes for mantras. But like the new meanings of mantra or mantra that includes positive sayings or personal affirmations, there's no use trying to fix or remove these contemporary adaptations. Mantras are here to stay in modern culture, as are Tibetan singing bowls, and now in Tibet. But by understanding a little more about their origins, maybe we can reflect on how they're presented to us today as authentic representations of some monolithic distant past, when almost always the past is more complex and intriguing than our stories. If you enjoy the show, sign up for my new Substack newsletter. It's going to include more material than I can fit in the podcast and some links to extra reading. You can find the sign up at malcolmkeating.substack.com. That's malcolmkeating.substack.com. Or you can go to Sutras and Stuff, all spelled out, for a link. See you next time.